afternoon. You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU-FM. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change here in the Dawnland. We explore topics such as restorative justice, restorative practices, decolonization, cultural revival, and more. Our guests are people involved in aspects of truth, healing, and change work. This program is offered in an effort to share, inspire, and inform. Dawnland Signals is a collaboration of Wabanaki Reach and WERU-FM.
Thank you, Maria. I am your co-host, Esther Ann, and today on Dawnland Signals, we are talking about a return to the teachings. We arrived at this topic after thinking about a particular tradition that's long practiced by Wabanaki people, and one that Reach is helping to revive, the New Year's forgiveness ceremony. Many of the customs and rituals that are embedded in Wabanaki culture are based on our core relational values, how we nurture our relationships and take care of one another and the world around us. It's really important to remember and state with the utmost certainty that these values still exist today, and to lift those values up and acknowledge the inherent goodness of Wabanaki people. We're so pleased to be able to share this discussion with you today. But before we welcome our special guest, we wanted to first start with an appreciation and acknowledgement of the land.
Thank you, Esther. Let's just take a moment to acknowledge the land beneath our feet, Wabanaki, the land of the first light, the dawn land, land that has known Wabanaki ancestors, the tallest trees and the oldest rivers, land that has known peace and conflict, land that has nourished us and sustained us since time immemorial. We acknowledge the indigenous peoples of this land, Wabanaki, the Passamaquoddy, the Penobscot, Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, and Abenaki, and we give thanks to your stewardship and resilience. We are broadcasting from WERU Studio in Blue Hill, Alamoosuc, Wabanaki.
Chiwiliwun, Maria. So we're so excited today to welcome respected Passamaquoddy Elder Wayne Newell from Madoknagook. I was looking for a succinct bio of Wayne, and it's really difficult because he's done so much for our people and for so many others around the country and around the world. But I found this one that was written for a children's curriculum, and I really like it. And again, it's only part of it. As an educational activist and scholar, Wayne has been involved in politics, education, economic development, and language revitalization among the Passamaquoddy over the last four decades. I think this is old, so I would say it's longer than that. Growing up at Indian Township, Madoknagook, the Passamaquoddy Reservation near Princeton, Maine, Wayne was raised by his grandmother, who taught him to be proud of his people and culture. They spoke to each other only in Passamaquoddy. His great-grandfather was Lewis Mitchell. He was a tribal representative to the Maine State Legislature, who gave a stirring historic speech about Passamaquoddy rights in 1887. Following in the footsteps of those two remarkable people, Wayne has tirelessly worked to create economic and political opportunities and keep Native languages and cultural traditions alive for Passamaquoddy and other Native people. Wayne was educated at Harvard University and was one of the first Passamaquoddy people to go to college. And just last week, there was a celebration, and several people, including Wayne, were sharing their experiences and going to Harvard. So welcome, Wayne. I'm so glad we were finally able to get together. We've been trying, huh?
Well, yeah. Thank you very much for that nice welcome. And I want to make one correction on that. The guy that wrote that way back when, got his things mixed up. I had a very good relationship with my grandmother, and in a sense, I guess she raised me, but I really was raised by my mother and father. But it's okay, I guess. And I'm glad to be here. I'm sitting here trying to figure out, my computer kind of messed up. So I'm just sitting here looking at it, and I'll pause now for I don't know how long to talk with everybody. And I'm so glad WERU has been a leader in diversity for many years, and I'm finally on the air with him. So I'm so glad to be here.
Nice. We're so glad to have you, Wayne, and we really appreciate how over so many decades you've been so open about sharing your knowledge with others. And so we're inviting you here today, just in that vein, to hear from you and to really find out what you've been up to lately.
Well, the newest thing, it happened today. I actually wrote a book, or edited a book, with my friend Robert Levitt, who I met at Harvard, actually, in 1971, when we were both graduate students in the School of Education. And so when I did the book, I wanted to edit a lot of stories that we had worked on since in the 70s. And we would print these little booklets, and they have long since been used up. And there was no more money from the Bilingual Education Fund to purchase more. So we decided to take all of the books and put them into a book. And I was the chief editor, and Robert, of course, helped me. We finally got the book, and it will be out for distribution, sale, and whatever. And I want to talk about that for a minute, because you know, when we say we're going to sell the books, yeah, we are, but we're creating a fund that is not going to benefit Robert or ourselves, except for the personal satisfaction of doing it. We will create a fund which will grow, hopefully, from our efforts and contributions from the bigger world. And we'll do all the publicity for that later on. This is very new, but I want to create something that other generations to follow me can use. You know, we need the resource, or they'll need the resources to carry on the work. And I don't want it to end when some of us pass away. And a lot of us have that are truly fluent in the language have a lot of people have passed away. I keep track of that. And there was one year, just a few years ago, I think it was 2016 or 15, we lost 15 fluent speakers of the Passamaquoddy language. And any time that happens, you lose such rich history of language and also cultural knowledge. And one of the things about this book is that it's written in both languages. When I was at Harvard, I also cross-registered to MIT, and I worked with a linguist, Dr. Kenneth Hale, and we worked on a writing system which was actually developed by a Harvard professor, a linguist, and I asked him if I could change aspects of the writing system so that we could type it. At that time, we didn't have any computers or word processors. Now it would be relatively easy, but at that point, it wasn't. And so I asked him permission. He said, and he was very flattered. He said, "You do anything you want." I told him that I wanted to train people in that language writing system. And that I did. And what we did was, one of the best things that happened was I enticed David Francis to come and work with us. and he just took to the system like a bear takes honey, I guess. That's the best way I can put it. And he became really a noted expert and worked with Robert on an idea that I had had early in the process. I said, I want a dictionary of the language. And they took up the banner on that one and worked on it tirelessly for many, many years and created a language committee. And I was on the committee. And so they worked and worked. And, of course, I consulted with them often. And we just published a few years ago probably one of the biggest dictionaries, at least in the Northeast, of native indigenous language. And it's we ran out of print because it sold like hotcakes. And we're trying to collect money now and for the University of Maine to print another edition of the dictionary. And Robert Levitt and I have been working on that just because we need to work on it. Nobody's paying us or anything for that. And so hopefully we'll have enough to reprint the dictionary. My dream was that every house in the Passamaquoddy community and the Maliseet community should have a dictionary in their house. And hopefully that'll happen. I get so wound up in this language revitalization thing that I forget other things.
What is the title of your book? What's the title of your book?
Okay, here it is. Yeah, I forget. I'm not on Zoom. It's called Book Musnug Agnud Mwingud, and it's a bilingual book, so I'll translate it. It says, stories our grandmothers told us. And my grandmother was certainly a leading advocate of storytelling, along with many other grandmothers in the community, because that, before television, before radios, and in a lot of ways, before electricity, because I grew up in a house, and I remember the day that they wired our house and started electricity. It changed the entire atmosphere, and I write about that a little bit in the book. Before that, it was oil lamps and candles. I remember that as a very young child, and there were many homes like that. And you know, this is a sort of a little trivia, but my grandma was the last, I think, of the community to have electricity. And I remember the date. It was 1967. So that's how it was. But with that, the storytelling was the chief activity. You know, it was like our television, I guess, or our radio. And we would go to different houses, or they would come to my grandmother's house. And when the nights that she would take care of us, which was sometimes when our parents went to Aroostook County for potato picking, we would stay with my grandma. And we would have supper, of course. And then after that, we would kind of gather around. And she had a big, big bed, and we would all sit in the bed, and she would sit there and start telling stories. And that's a very, very beautiful memory that I have. And all of us children in our family, at that time it was three, and then she had another daughter who had one son, and he would be there, and some other relatives. There would be a crowd there. And these are memories that's why I wanted to print the book, is because I think that that's been replaced, unfortunately, in some ways, by television and radio, where you don't have interaction that much with your constituents. So
I was thinking that lack of connection. My mother, this is Esther. My mother used to tell me that back when she was little, they after supper, when things were done, they'd sit around and people would visit and just talk with each other, you know, with the oil lamp and candles.
That's right.
Yeah. A lot more connection, right?
I remember while talking with your mom, and she was very big on people sitting and talking with each other and telling each other either about the community or about the stories. And it was not gossip. It was constructive stuff so that we could live together as a unit, because the tribal value there was to be part of a unit. You were never encouraged to be a loner. You were part of the community, and there were certain responsibilities that went with that. And one of them was sharing as much as possible your knowledge, or sharing in a sense if you were having a difficult time and that kind of thing. And there were many other ways, but there were also obstructions to that when we came face to face with another culture. And so I remember talking with her a lot about that, because we worked on various projects together over time. I think we worked on a movie together too. And anyway, did she ever talk about a house with no electricity?
Yes, all the time. No running water, no toilet.
Right, yeah. There you go. Yeah. Yeah, that was a standard. The thing that I remember about this running water and stuff, I remember the construction people coming across the bay when the tide was out, cutting a channel, and they laying a pipe. And the pipe went over to the convent and to the priest's house. But that was long before anybody else in the community had indoor running water or indoor bathrooms, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember that. I never forgot that. I thought it was strange at the time, because we didn't have those facilities until the late 60s, early 70s. And a lot of people in the state really don't know that, because we were so invisible. I think that before the highway came, cut the reservation in half, we didn't have a direct connection to the outside community. We lived in a very beautiful spot, 100 acres, and the village was right there. And then in the late 50s, I think the bridge to Eastport, Maine, was getting old, and I didn't think they wanted to rebuild it. So what they did was survey, and they could have a solid road to the island of Eastport via our community, and that's what they did. And of course, we had very little say about it. And my mother told me that there was a lot of opposition to it, but you know, it just didn't go anywhere. That's one of my great grandfather's part of his speech, and it's still I think it's on the internet.
I think it is. We reference it in some of Reach's work. I just wanted to just interrupt just for a second, Wayne. You're listening to Wayne Newell on Dawnland Signals on WERU-FM. I'm your co-host, Esther Ann, along with Maria Gerard. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change. Today, we're talking about a return to the teachings, and time is just flying. Listening to Wayne, I could listen to you all night. So sorry to interrupt you, but you were talking about your grandfather's speech.
Yeah, it was talking about a lot of the things that we talked about later on, because one of the sad things about that, it's a beautiful, beautiful speech. speech about our indigenous rights. But the only thing the state government did at that time in the 1800s was to order X number of copies to be printed of your speech. But that pretty much did not much happened after that. And again, I could go on and on about our relationship with the state, but I don't want to do that for this particular broadcast because I think that it's important to get a message out in terms of survival. We are very much in a critical state right now as an indigenous group of people because of things that happen. Technology is one of them. Technology can either be our friend or it can be our enemy. It all depends on which road that we take. In our case, with language revitalization, technology is very much a friend of ours because we can, well, we can write books. We can do a lot of stuff with internet, with communications. And so it's not as much of an enemy as people would think. There was this old anthropological thinking long time ago that maybe if we make them like us, they'll be somebody. And that's not the case. And you did a program on decolonization, and I think that is very much going to be the trend in education. I know my son is spending a lot of time on it, and there are others. Dr. Marie Batiste, who was with me on the Harvard broadcast, is teaching in Canada, because Canada's doing a lot with developing a curriculum and an idea of thinking in decolonization. And she mentioned some of it, if you saw the broadcast. Incidentally, that is available on YouTube right now. I think they had it yesterday, and I think that if people tune in on YouTube, they can watch that particular thing and see how we students that were recruited made out. And what they did was it's interesting. What they did was there was a lot of OEO money. OEO is economic opportunity. Way back in the Lyndon Johnson administration, after the assassination of Kennedy, of course, he became president, and he started the war on poverty. And one of the things that happened was higher education got a lot of some resources, not a lot, but some resources to bring indigenous people into the system so that they can go back into their communities or elsewhere to work on critical issues. And they only had enough money at that time to recruit 11 of us. And I fortunately was one of the 11. And you know, I've since gone back and worked in my community as, you know, with the language issue, because I think without your language, I don't think you can express your values adequately in somebody else's language. And so it's important that that we try to teach our young ones to have a conversation. And it's a very... the process of doing it is you have to be very patient because it's a very slow process. And we worked, at least I worked a few years ago on language immersion right in the classroom with 2 and 3 year olds. And boy, their minds are so open. They are so rich for absorbing this. And it was a lot of fun. I worked with Dolly App, who was also worked on the dictionary with David and Bob, and some other people that were doing it, and it was so much fun. I wanted to get into the classroom a little bit more, and so I did. And I tell you, especially with story time, even if they didn't understand it, they got the spirit. These young ones got the spirit of what you were doing, and they were totally absorbed in it. And I encourage immersion. I encourage the adults in our community to become involved, because everyone is a teacher who speaks the language. And if you could only, it's like David. David was a gardener or something. He had a big family. Somehow I talked him into coming with us, and he just ate it all up. I mean, he was just a natural. And of course, he goes back my mother's age. And he died a few years ago in his 90s. That's how rich we can go back if there are older people that can teach you. And I learned so much from him. And where he got his knowledge was his grandparents. So you go back way back, and that's how it's done. So
I really appreciate hearing about this phenomenal life work that you have participated in, and you know, it will surely, language revitalization will surely be your legacy. I'm just listening and loving all these stories of days past, and I was scribbling down some words that were said, being part of a unit and connectedness and sharing. And it got me thinking about, you know, these are all teachings, and it got me thinking about the conversation that we had a month or so ago, and we were talking about the forgiveness ceremony that the tribes had. Could you share a little bit about that forgiveness ceremony, the New Year's?
Oh yeah, I'm glad you reminded me, because I go off sometimes in my brain just goes all over the place. So please guide me so I can talk about those kinds of things. And the forgiveness ceremony is something that I observed as a very young boy. And two times it would happen. One is when somebody was getting ready to pass into the spirit world. And the other one was nowadays, it was on New Year's Day. I'll talk about the New Year's Day one first. People would go to other people's houses, sometimes their relatives or their good friends or somebody, maybe they weren't such good friends. And they would say, "And help them win, Donigizi Wablil Wayo, Nil Nakton help them all." And that means, forgive me for any offenses I might have committed during the past year. And I also forgive you for any offenses you may have offended against me. And so you start the year off with a clean slate. You put all of that away. And people would do that in our community. Elders would take the leadership role in that, and they would encourage young people to not forget it and to utilize it. Even, you know, if it's your playmates, you know, and we could do that. But they encouraged that kind of a behavior. And the other part was when somebody was getting ready to pass and it's very critical and they were still able to communicate, you would take their hand and you would say the same words again. And help them win. Don't only give you a little way, will unpin. You'll not unhelp them all. And so, again, you would ask forgiveness, except for this is a longer period of time for both lifetimes of people that were participating in this. And that would be, for all of their years, maybe. And especially if you had a difficult relationship with somebody and you would ask forgiveness for any offenses you might have committed against them. And then you would also say, for any offenses you might have committed against me, I also forgive you. And it's a very beautiful thing. And as I grew older, I saw it some more, except I saw that certain people were doing it, but not as many as when I was younger. I have done it. As a matter of fact, the last time I did it, I'm just trying to think right now. The last time, one of the times I did it was when my own mother was passing, and the hospital called me up and told me that there was a problem, and they took her to the emergency room. And when I got there, the doctors told me that she was passing because of a blood clot or something to that effect. And so I went into the room, and there was my wife and my son there. I did it. I think my mother was still able to hear us. And so I performed that particular ceremony. And then soon thereafter, she passed into the spirit world. But there were other times that I did it. And the families, I have never found a family that would say no. I think that everybody remembers that, at least, you know, my age or older, and maybe even younger. But I wanted people to see it, because if you don't teach it that way, it will die out, or it become a memory for everybody. And that's not the way to preserve values or culture. So that's what I know about the forgiveness ceremony. Rename it something. I'm not quite sure what we'd rename it as. It's beautiful, though.
It is. Wayne, this is Esther. I'm going to try to say it in the language. Is it Gesunny Gwents or something like that, when you do the red after somebody passes, and to signify the mourning?
Yes.
On the teeth and the... How do you say it? I don't know if I said it right.
Which one? What word, Sally?
When you put the red on the cheeks and the forehead when somebody passes.
Oh yeah, that again, that's changed over the years. It used to be you didn't do it immediately. We do now, but in the younger days, people would wait. I think it would be either a week or a month. I'm not quite sure, but it would not be immediate like it is now. And Gossi Gwennell.
There you go.
You were close. Gossi Gwennell. And Gossi Gwentin is when you're announcing that ceremony. Gossi Gwentin. And what we could figure out is that's something that came from the red paint people, who kind of disappeared. But that the okra, I don't know how to pronounce it.
Red,
the red
okra? Yeah.
Red. is descended from that particular culture. They were indigenous culture, but somehow or rather they you don't hear much about them, you know, in so-called modern times. But that the red okra, I guess that's what you call it, is descended from that, and the ceremony probably is too. And that signifies, actually, what it signifies was the end of the mourning period. That's what I know about it anyway. Gossi Gwentin means that it's I don't know how to translate Gossi Gwentin, but you were close when you were saying it. That's why I remembered it.
Yeah.
And now it's immediately after the burial.
Well,
and I don't know
my mother explained it to, I can tell Sorry, Wayne. My mother explained that in the old days when people, you know, they stayed together and didn't travel much, it would be after a period of time, like maybe a year,
right,
that they would do that. But she said when people started having to leave and they weren't living there anymore, then relatives would come home for the service. They would be the ones that could get it and then go home.
Oh, that's probably why it changed over the years then.
Yeah,
that's true. You reminded me of something. If you are close to somebody, let's say it's your husband or your wife, right? Then you would mourn officially for a longer period of time. And I've heard a year, I've heard a month. But if you are not particularly related, I guess what I mean by close, then you would have a shorter period of time. I think, you know, and I think that's traveling, for example, from one community to another. Let's say it was Maliseets that came to the service. Well, they wouldn't be there necessarily when the time ended, so that's probably why they did it right away. And then it kind of got more convenient, I guess, after a while. And now we do it right after the ceremony. And if families do it, you know, a longer period, I don't know about it, but I know we didn't. We did it. It was done. Usually there's somebody in charge of it. The last one that was in charge of it was Marjorie LeCout. Her mother was Lillian LeCout. She was sort of the head cultural reminder. Sometimes they have to remind the young people of certain things, and she was very good at it. She was very compassionate about teaching something to the young people so they would remember. You didn't give them hell. You did it in a loving way, and that way they would remember that. And all of the memories that I have, and you probably are the same way, Esther, was because somebody lovingly told you about a value. And that's the way to carry on something, instead of, you know, making them feel bad for not knowing it. Because we have encountered a culture 400, 500 years ago, and yet we still survive, and we still maintain some elements and precious elements of our culture. And I think we ought to give ourselves credit for that. We ought to be thankful for that, because we need to teach our neighbors, our white neighbors, who we really are, not what they would like us to be. Mm-hmm. And I'm very strong about standing tall when it comes to us as indigenous people. And I think I learned that because I learned when I was in first grade, I think, there was a nun that came. She didn't stay a nun, incidentally, but we would be talking past Macquarie, all of us children. And she came and she said, "Don't you speak that language in the school, you know?" And it wasn't very, I don't know. I guess I still talk about it, so I must have created quite a memory in my memory bank. And my grandmother, on the other hand, was militant on the other side because she didn't want us to speak English at her house. And I think she saw that it was important to teach us our own language and to speak our own language. And when I was a kid, all of the houses that had indigenous parents spoke the language to their children, and that is the best teacher of all. As difficult sometimes to convince adults, you know, that if they do this, that, they will have speakers of the language. It's like in education, if you help kids do their, get involved in their school curriculum, whatever it happens to be, they're going to be more enthusiastic about education. And, you know, it's just a matter of how attitude and how information is given.
Absolutely. I need to interrupt for just a quick second to say that you are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU FM. I am your co-host, Maria Gerard, along with co-host Esther Ann. And today we are talking about a return to the teach-ins with our special guest, Wayne Newell. And Wayne, I love all of these stories that you're sharing with us. I'm taking so much away from what you were saying. I was wondering, we have a short amount of time available. I think we've got about 15 minutes left. But I was wondering, going back to your book that you talked about at the beginning of the show, the stories our grandmothers told us. I was just wondering, what kinds of stories can be found in that book? Is there any one particular that you might say is your favorite one?
I think it's a... there was a lady that worked with me, Mary Ellen Soccer Basin Stevens, or Stephen Soccer Basin, I guess it was. She wrote a book, or a story, actually, of life of a Passamaquoddy girl in the 1920s. And what she did was go to the elders of the community, and I, at the time she did it, I was not an elder, but she lists me as one of the people. Hold on just a second, I'm trying to, oh yeah, here we go. And she lists all of these people in the text. Well, she was, this is one of the little pamphlets I was talking about. And so what we did was transcribe that all in Passamaquoddy. And then there's another column in the book of the English translation. And it's called Mullion, which is Mary Ann. And that's probably one of the big favorites that I have. I put that first in the book. I'm just looking at the book now. That's why I'm... And there were, I'm trying to count the, hold on just a second, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 students. There was a school at on the strip, they call it. That's the little village before you cross the bridge into Princeton. And there were 9 students at the time, and their teacher's name was Mrs. Wellington. I'm going to do a little research on her, see who she was. Anyway, one-room schoolhouse, and they were these beautiful students, and all of them have passed on now. One of them was a good fishing buddy of mine, David Soctoma. Anyway, the book talks about what the place looked like, what people, there wasn't very many houses on the strip as they are now. There was only a few, they called it a strip because there was like a little strip of native homes, and there was a lot of encroachment on the part of non-natives onto tribal land. And that got, of course, that got settled in the Land Claims, 1980 Land Claims Act. The story talks about the customs at the time, different things happened, who lived with who, and it even has a section of the father and the daughter, who was Mullion, going to Pleasant Point, and they would go to Princeton, where the passenger train would come. That's when the railroad was pretty good in 1920, I guess. And they would go to Calais and change trains, and go to Ayers Junction and change trains, and it stopped at Pleasant Point, and that's where they would go. And they talk about the trip, and they would exchange food. And there was a lot of fish products that they would take back to their house. She just talks about life in general. And it's a really nice story. And it was well done, well researched. And it was from the thought processes of the older people who remembered, either through their grandparents or parents, what life was like, or some of them, I don't think any of them were born before 1920, but that's one of my favorite ones. And the other favorite one that I have is kind of fun. It's Lizzie Newell. I don't know, there must be a relationship there somewhere, but she did it. I'm just going to the page right now. That's why I'm pausing. She did a little skit on how a fly washes its face. And she went through all of the, of course, it's all in Passamaquoddy, with translation, of course. She goes through it with her hands and her facial expressions. And all the time she's doing it, Robert Levitt is snapping pictures of her, telling the story. It was so much fun doing it. And of course, we're all laughing. And Lizzie, if you got to know her, she was just a natural-born Passamaquoddy comedian, however you say that, and comedianess, I guess. And she would just make you things so light and so much fun. And that, we had to put that in the book. And it's all illustrated with pictures, with what she says, okay? The fly does this, and then this, and then this, and then in the end, I'm not going to spoil it, because the end is kind of neat. And
I remember seeing that book and how it was used in, you know, the early parts of language learning. These very simple steps, and I had the pictures. Yeah, that's a great one. I love hearing the joy in your voice when you're talking about these stories, Wayne. You probably can't hear yourself, but when you talk about it and how you really come alive. So.
Oh, well, the rest of the stories, in a sense, there was a section here about my great-grandfather, Lewis Mitchell, but before that section, there is always stories with, how do I say that? Good and not good. Good and evil, I guess. The forces are always battling each other in the stories. And so you have what we would call contemporary times, ghost stories. Mm-hmm. You would have people who have passed, and you would have, just an assortment of that kind of a storytelling. And again, I'm editing these stories. I'm not claiming authorship. Well, except the one that they authored, and it's noted, you know, authored by Wayne Newell. Mm-hmm. And there was a lady, your mother was real good friends of her, Elizabeth LeCoute, over. She lived almost across from your house, where, yep. What you grew up in. They called
her.
Yep. Huh?
I remember
I'm losing
her.
You. I'm losing you.
I remember her. Yep. I remember her, Wayne.
Well, anyway, she sat down with me years ago and told me some stories, some Zeke Eliam and some others. And, of course, I have since literally memorized those because I love them. I mean, I just think that, you know, and it was all okay until her son, Arthur, came in and told her he's going to put those on the Ed Sullivan Show. So she stopped recording with me after that. You know, I think she believed her son, even though I denied it. I don't know why. Anyway, so we got some stories from her, of which some of them I edited shortly. I didn't want to change too much. Hazel, what's her name? Hazel, your mother's sister.
Uh-huh, Dana. Dana.
Yeah, okay. She gave me a tape of what I had recorded. She had it on a tape recording. Somehow or other, after I left the school to start the health system at the township, my tape got lost when they were taking stuff and putting it in the new school and what it was called, the new school at that time. It got lost in the shuffle. So I had to kind of revise this story that Lizzie told me from memory. And that's why I'm listed with her as part of the story. But I tell you, she was a classic person for storytelling. The whole, let me just give you a sample in the native language of what it would sound like. That does he, Gilliam? Uh-huh. Valeo. Madagag mitsiwig. Na chan one, knijaluk. Elimi mata you. Elimi mata you. So that's a part of the dialogue. She acts out the dialogue in her, and you reminded me of what you said about me, but if you saw her, my God, you think she was fit for a performance somewhere, you know, and she did this with her own children and grandchildren because she was a strong, strong cultural teacher. And
she was a midwife, isn't it, Wayne? Wasn't she the last midwife in our community?
She was, yeah. Yeah, she was. And the last child, I think she midwife was my former neighbor, Frankie Toma, and his wife, Frances.
Uh-huh.
And she was a midwife for a couple of those children. But I don't remember her doing much after that. I think her eyesight was starting to get to her and... But I do remember that. There were a lot of people like her. Another one was your own grandmother, Kitty.
Uh huh.
Yeah, but I don't have anything by her. I do remember her telling stories, but I don't remember. You know, I don't remember recording anything, and that's a shame because she was telling me one story of someone that got run over on the railroad tracks, right? And they said they took the suspected person to court in Machias. This is probably a very contemporary story in that time. And so they were talking about having this person testify. And he said, and this is the dialogue. I saw the train coming, and the train saw me coming. And I guess with that kind of dialogue, the judge just threw it out of court. There was nothing done. I mean, nobody was hurt or anything because they probably got out of the way before the train got there. But the fact that he said the train saw me coming was something the judge would not understand. I call it Passamaquoddy English. Because we have a way of speaking English or having some fun with it. I remember one time that Walter Cronkite at Dana Point was called Walter Crankcase. And you know all the nicknames down at Zibaye? Those
yeah.
are, a lot of them are just broken English. And we don't have as much of it these days. I kind of wish we did because they were very entertaining.
Oh, gee, I can't believe our time has flown. We have probably 2 minutes left.
2 minutes. Wow.
I know. It went fast.
I really, really, really enjoyed it. And I thank you all for inviting me. I hope it's been a good experience for all of you. I know it's been a good experience for me. And I smell supper. My wife is, and I can smell something good. I wonder what we'll have for supper. Anyway, I thank you all. And just keep an eye on the local papers. And we'll be making a thing for the book in case people want to order the book. I don't like to do this, but it's not very expensive. It's only $25. Try buying a college book nowadays. More than $25. Anyway, thank you. And Maria, thank you too.
Thank you, Wayne. So much, and thank you to the listeners for joining us on Dawnland Signals. Thank you to the volunteer technician Jeffrey Hodgkiss for his assistance and support. Be sure to join us next month, April 15th, and every Thursday of the month for Dawnland Signals and more conversations of truth, healing, and change. Stay tuned here at WERU-FM for the upcoming program, Radioactive with Meredith DeFrancesco.